Success demands action. All success is based upon power, and power grows out of knowledge that has been organized and expressed in terms of action. The world pays for but one kind of knowledge, the kind that is expressed in constructive service. In addressing the graduating class of a business college, one of the best-known bankers in America said, "You ought to feel proud of your diplomas because they are evidence that you have been preparing yourselves for action in the great field of business." One of the advantages of a business college training is that it prepares you for action. Not to belittle other methods of education, but to exalt the modern business college method, I am reminded to say that there are some colleges in which the majority of the students are preparing for practically everything else except action. You came to this business college with but one object in view, and that object is to learn to render service and earn a living. The latest style of clothing has been of little interest to you because you have been preparing yourself for work in which clothes of the latest style will play no important part. You did not come here to learn how to pour tea at an afternoon party, nor to become masters at affecting friendliness while inwardly feeling envy for those who wear finer gowns and drive costly motor cars. You came here to learn how to work. In the graduating class before which this man spoke were 13 boys, all of whom were so poor that they had barely enough money with which to pay their way, and some were having to work before and after school hours. That was 25 years ago. Last summer, I met the president of the business college that these boys attended, and he gave me the history of each of them, from the time they graduated until the time I talked with him. One of them is president of one of the big wholesale drug companies, and a wealthy man. One is a successful lawyer. Two own large business colleges of their own. One is a professor in the Department of Economics at one of the largest universities in America. One is president of one of the large automobile manufacturing companies. Two are presidents of banks and wealthy men. One is the owner of a large department store. One is vice president of one of the great railway systems of the country. One is a well-established certified public accountant. One is dead, and the 13th is myself. 11 successes out of a class of 13 boys is not a bad record, thanks to the spirit of action developed by that business college training. It is not the schooling you have had that counts. It is the extent to which you express that which you learned from your schooling through well-organized and intelligently directed action. By no means would I belittle higher education, but I would offer hope and encouragement to those who have had no such education, provided they express what they do know, no matter how little, in intensive action along constructive lines. Abraham Lincoln, one of the greatest presidents who ever occupied the White House, had little schooling. But he did such a good job of expressing what knowledge he acquired by that little schooling through properly directed action that his name has been inseparably woven into the history of the United States. Every city, town, and hamlet has its population of ne'er-do-wells, and if you will analyze these unfortunate people, you will observe that one of their most notable characteristics is procrastination. Lack of action has caused them to slip backward into a rut, where they will remain unless they are unexpectedly forced out and unusual action becomes necessary. Don't let yourself get into that situation. Every office and every shop and every bank and every store and every other place of employment has its outstanding victims of procrastination who are marching down the dusty road of failure because they have not developed the habit of expressing themselves in action. You can't pick out these unfortunates if you will begin to analyze those with whom you come in contact each day. If you will talk to them, you will observe that they have built up a false philosophy, such as, "I am doing all I am paid to do, and I am getting by." Yes, they are getting by, but that is all they are getting. Some years ago, at a time when labor was scarce and wages unusually high, I observed scores of able-bodied men lying about in the parks of Chicago, doing nothing. I became curious to know what sort of an explanation they would offer for their conduct, so I went out one afternoon and interviewed 7 of them. With the aid of a generous supply of cigars and cigarettes and a little loose change, I bought myself into the confidence of those whom I interviewed and thereby gained a rather intimate view of their philosophy. All gave exactly the same reason for being there, unemployed, saying, The world will not give me a chance. Think of it. The world would not give them a chance. Of course the world wouldn't give them a chance. It never gives anyone a chance. Anyone who wants a chance may create it through action, but if they wait for someone to hand it to them on a silver platter, they will meet with disappointment. I fear the excuse that the world does not give someone a chance is quite prevalent, and I strongly suspect that it is one of the commonest causes of poverty and failure. The seventh man that I interviewed on that well-spent afternoon was an unusually fine-looking specimen, physically. He was lying on the ground asleep, with a newspaper over his face. When I lifted the paper, he reached up, took it out of my hands, put it back over his face, and went right on sleeping. Then I used a little strategy by removing the paper from his face and placing it behind me where he could not get it. He then sat up on the ground, and I interviewed him. That fellow was a graduate from two of the great universities in the East, with a master's degree from one and a PhD from the other. His story was pathetic. He had held job after job, but always his employer or his fellow employee had it in for him. He hadn't been able to make them see the value of his college training. They wouldn't give him a chance. Here was a man who might have been at the head of some great business or an outstanding figure in one of the professions had he not chosen to procrastinate and hold on to the false belief that the world should pay him for what he knew. Luckily, most college graduates do not opt for such choices, because no college can bring success to the person who tries to collect for what they know instead of what they can do with what they know. The man to whom I referred was from one of the best-known families of Virginia. He traced his ancestry back to the landing of the Mayflower. He threw back his shoulders, pounded himself on the chest with his fist, and said, "Just think of it, sir. I am the son of one of the first families of old Virginia." My observations led me to believe that, being the son of a first family, is not always fortunate either for the son or the family. Too often these sons of first families try to slide home from third base on their family names. This may be only a peculiar notion of mine, but I have observed that the men and women who are doing the world's work have but little time and less inclination to brag about their ancestry. Not long ago, I took a trip back to Southwest Virginia, where I was born. It was the first time I'd been there in over 20 years. It was a sad sight to compare the sons of some of those who were known as first families 20 years ago with the sons of those who were but plain folk who made it their business to express themselves in action of the most intensive nature. The comparison reflected no credit upon the first family boys. It is with no feeling of exaltation that I express my gratitude for not having been brought into the world by parents from a first family. That, of course, was not a matter of choice with me, and if it had been, perhaps I, too, would have selected parents of the first family type. Not long ago, I was invited to deliver an address in Boston, Massachusetts. After my work was finished, a reception committee volunteered to show me the sights of the city, including a trip to Cambridge, where we visited Harvard University. While there, I observed many sons of first families, some of whom had Packards. 20 years ago, I would have felt proud to be a student at Harvard, with a Packard car, but the illuminating effect of my more mature years has led me to the conclusion that, had I had the privilege of going to Harvard, I might have done just as well without the aid of a Packard. Editor's Comment. For anyone unfamiliar with the Packard, they were expensive grand luxury cars known for their quality construction, extreme durability, and classic styling. The latter, no doubt, being why they showed up at Harvard. The first Packard automobile was produced in 1899 in Warren, Ohio, at the Packard Electric Company's subsidiary plant, the New York and Ohio Company. The Packard division began as the Ohio Automobile Company and became the Packard Motor Car Company in 1902. Production ceased in 1958, but today there are still Packard car clubs, a museum, and the Packard Motor Car Foundation, a nonprofit educational organization dedicated to the preservation of the products and history of the Packard Motor Car Company. Returning to Napoleon Hill's original text. I noticed some Harvard boys who had no Packards. They were working as waiters in the restaurant where I ate, and as far as I could see, they were missing nothing of value by not owning a Packard. Nor did they seem to be suffering by comparison with those who could boast of first family parents. All of which is no reflection upon Harvard University, one of the great universities of the world, nor upon the first families who send boys to Harvard. To the contrary, it is intended as a bit of encouragement to those unfortunates who, like myself, have but little and know but little, but express what little they know in terms of constructive, useful action. The psychology of inaction is one of the chief reasons why some towns and cities are dying. In one city in Maine, for example, laws have closed up all the restaurants on Sunday. Railroad trains must slow down to 12 miles an hour while passing through the city. Keep off the grass signs are prominently displayed in the parks. Unfavorable city ordinances of one sort or another have driven the best industries to other cities. Evidence of restraint can be seen everywhere. The people on the street show signs of restraint in their faces and in their manner and in their walk. The mass psychology of the city is negative. The moment one gets off the train at the depot, this negative atmosphere becomes depressingly obvious and makes one want to take the next train out again. The place reminds one of a graveyard, and the people resemble walking ghosts. They register no signs of action. The financial statements of the banking institutions reflect this negative, inactive state of mind. The stores reflect it in their show windows and in the faces of their salespeople. I went into one of the stores to buy a pair of socks. A young woman with bobbed hair, who would have been a flapper if she hadn't been too lazy, threw a box of socks on the counter. When I picked up the box, looked at the socks, and registered a look of disapproval on my face, she languidly yawned, "They're the best you can get in this dump." She must have been a mind reader, for dump was the word that was in my mind before she spoke. The store reminded me of a rubbish dump. The city reminded me of the same. I felt the stuff getting into my own blood. The negative psychology of the people was actually reaching out and gathering me in. Maine is not the only state that is afflicted with a city such as the one I have described. I could name others, but I might wish to go into politics someday. Therefore, I will leave it to you to do your own analyzing and comparing of cities that are alive with action and those that are slowly dying from inaction. I know of some business concerns that are in this same state of inaction, but I will omit their names. You probably know some too. Many years ago, Frank A. Vanderlip, who is one of the best-known and most capable bankers in America, went to work for the National City Bank of New York City. His salary was above average from the start because he was capable and had a record of successful achievement that made him a valuable man. He was assigned to a private office that was equipped with a fine mahogany desk. On the desk was an electric push button connected to a secretary's desk outside. The first day went by without any work coming to his desk. The second and the third and the fourth days went by without any work. No one came in or said anything to him. He was feeling very uneasy. Men of action always feel uneasy when there is no work in sight. So Mr. Vanderlip went into the president's office and said, "Look here, you are paying me a big salary and giving me nothing to do, and it is grating on my nerves." The president looked up with a lively twinkle in his keen eyes. "Now I have been thinking," Mr. Vanderlip continued, "while sitting in there with nothing to do, of a plan for increasing the business of this bank." The president assured him that both thinking and plans were valuable and asked him to continue. "I have thought of a plan," Mr. Vanderlip went on, "that will give the bank the benefit of my experience in the bond business. I propose to create a bond department for this bank and advertise it as a feature of our business." "What? This bank advertise?" queried the president. "Why, we have never advertised since we began business, and we have managed to get along without it." "Well, this is where you are going to begin advertising," said Mr. Vanderlip. "And the first thing you're going to advertise is this new bond department that I have planned." Mr. Vanderlip won. Men of action usually win. That is one of their distinctive characteristics. The National City Bank also won, because that conversation was the beginning of one of the most progressive and profitable advertising campaigns ever carried on by any bank, with the result that National City Bank became one of the most powerful financial institutions in America. There were other results, too. Mr. Vanderlip grew with the bank, as men of action usually grow in whatever they help to build, until finally he became the president of that great banking house. Cooperation of Mind and Body. In the lesson on imagination, Volume 2, you learned how to recombine old ideas into new plans. But no matter how practical your plans may be, they will be useless if they are not expressed in action. To dream dreams and see visions of the person you would like to be, or the station in life you would like to obtain, are admirable, provided you transform your dreams and visions into reality through intensive action. There are people who dream but do nothing more. There are others who take the visions of the dreamers and translate them into stone and marble and music and good books and railroads and steamships. There are still others who both dream and transform their dreams into reality. They are the dreamer-doer types. There is a psychological as well as an economic reason why you should form the habit of intensive action. Your body is made up of billions of tiny cells that are highly sensitive and amenable to the influence of your mind. If your mind is lethargic and inactive, the cells of your body become lazy and inactive also. If you doubt this, the next time you feel lazy, think about an activity of which you are fond, and notice how quickly the cells of your body will respond to your enthusiasm and your lazy feeling will disappear. The cells of the body respond to the state of mind in exactly the same manner that the people of a city respond to the mass psychology that dominates the city. If a group of leaders engages in sufficient action to give the city the reputation of being an alive city, this action influences all who live there. The same principle applies to the relationship between the mind and the body. An active, dynamic mind keeps the cells of the body in a constant state of activity. The amount of work that I perform every day and still keep in good physical condition is a source of wonderment and mystery to those who know me well. Yet, there is no mystery to it, and the system I follow does not cost anything. First, I drink a cup of hot water when I first get up in the morning, before I have breakfast. My breakfast consists of rolls made of whole wheat and bran, breakfast cereal, fruit, soft-boiled eggs once in a while, and coffee. For lunch, I eat vegetables, most any kind, whole wheat bread, and drink a glass of buttermilk. And for supper, a well-cooked steak once or twice a week, vegetables, especially lettuce, and coffee. I walk an average of 10 miles a day, 5 miles into the country and 5 miles back, using this period for meditation and thought. Perhaps the thinking is as valuable to my health as the walk. You cannot be a person of action if you overeat and under-exercise. Neither can you be a person of action if you run to the pill bottle every time you have, or imagine you have, an ache or a pain. I have not touched a drug in more than 5 years, and I have not been either sick or ailing during that time, in spite of the fact that I perform more work each day than most men of my profession. I have enthusiasm, endurance, and action because I eat the simple foods that contain the bodybuilding elements that I require. There is another enemy you must conquer before you can become a person of action, and that is the worry habit. Worry, envy, jealousy, hatred, doubt, and fear are all states of mind that are fatal to action. These negative states of mind destroy the most essential factor in the achievement of success: the desire to achieve. In Definite Chief Aim, the second lesson, Volume 1 of this course, you learned that your chief aim in life should be supported by a burning desire for its realization. You can have no burning desire for achievement when you are in a negative state of mind, no matter what the cause may be. I have discovered a very effective way to keep myself in a positive frame of mind. When I feel out of sorts or inclined to argue with somebody over something that is not worthy of discussion, I get away to where I will disturb no one and I have a good hearty laugh. If I can find nothing really funny to laugh about, I simply have a forced laugh. The effect is the same in both cases. 5 minutes of this sort of mental and physical exercise, for it is both, will stimulate action that is free from negativity. Do not just take my word for this. Try it. Not long ago, I heard a record entitled, as I recall, The Laughing Fool. It was all that its name implies. The record was made by a man and a woman. The man was trying to play a cornet, and the woman was laughing at him. She laughed so effectively that she finally made the man laugh, and the suggestion was so pronounced that all who heard it usually joined in, whether they felt like it or not. Editor's comment. Many of Napoleon Hill's beliefs about the power of the mind that were considered unconventional in his time became part of mainstream medical and psychological practice by the latter years of the 20th century. A number of seminal books on what is now commonly referred to as the body-mind connection were published in the 1970s and 1980s. One such book is Anatomy of an Illness, in which author Norman Cousins documents his use of laughter to help heal a painful and near-fatal illness. Other books that speak to the power of laughter are The Laughter Prescription by Dr. Lawrence J. Peter, The Healing Power of Humor by Alan Klein, and Laughter, the Best Medicine by Robert Holden. Back to Napoleon Hill's original text. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. You cannot think fear and act courageously. You cannot think hatred and act in a kindly manner toward others. And the dominating thoughts of your mind, meaning the strongest, deepest, and most frequent of your thoughts, influence the physical action of your body. Every thought put into action by your brain reaches and influences every cell in your body. When you think fear, your mind telegraphs this thought to the cells that form the muscles of your legs and tells those muscles to get into action and carry you away as rapidly as they can. A person who is afraid runs away because their legs carry them, and they carry them because the fear thought in the person's mind instructed them to do so, even though the instructions were given unconsciously. In the first lesson of this course, you learned how thought travels from one mind to another through the principle of telepathy. In this lesson, you should go a step further and learn that your thoughts not only register themselves in the minds of other people through the principle of telepathy, but what is a million times more important for you to understand is that they register themselves on the cells of your own body and affect those cells in a manner that harmonizes with the nature of the thoughts. Action, in the sense that the term is used in this lesson, is of two forms. One is physical and the other is mental. You can be very active with your mind while your body is entirely inactive, or you can be very active with both body and mind. Inspire cooperative and personal action. There are essentially two kinds of people of action. One might be called the caretaker type and the other the promoter or salesperson type. Both types are essential in business, industry, and finance. One is known as a dynamo, while the other is often referred to as a balance wheel. Once in a great while, you will find someone who is both a dynamo and a balance wheel, but such a personality combination is rare. Most successful business organizations are made up of both types. The balance wheel, who does nothing but compile facts and figures and statistics, is just as much a person of action as the one who gets on a stage and sells an idea to 1,000 people by the sheer power of their active personality. To determine whether someone is a person of action or not, it is necessary to analyze both their mental and their physical habits. Earlier in this lesson, I said that the world pays you for what you do and not for what you know. That statement might easily be misconstrued. What the world really pays you for is what you do or what you can get others to do. A person who can induce others to cooperate and do effective teamwork, or inspire others so that they become more active, is no less a person of action than the one who renders effective service in a more direct manner. In the field of industry and business, there are people who have the ability to so inspire and direct the efforts of others that all under their direction accomplish more than they could without this directing influence. Andrew Carnegie so ably directed the efforts of those who constituted his personal staff that he made many wealthy men of those who would never have become wealthy without the directing genius of his mind. The same may be said of practically all great leaders in the field of industry and business. The gain is not all on the side of the leaders. Those under their direction often profit most by their leadership. In the first lesson of this course, the value of allied effort was particularly emphasized for the reason that some people have the vision to plan, while others, although they do not have the imagination or the vision to create the plans, have the ability to carry those plans into action. It was his understanding of this principle of allied effort that enabled Andrew Carnegie to surround himself with a group of men that was made up of those who could plan and those who could execute. Carnegie had in his group of assistants some of the most efficient salesmen in the world, but if his entire staff had been made up of men who could do nothing but sell, he could never have accumulated the fortune that he did. Action, in the sense that it is used in this lesson, must be intelligently guided. One of the best-known law firms in America is made up of two lawyers, one of whom never appears in court. He prepares the firm's cases for trial, and the other member of the firm goes to court and tries them. Both are men of intense action, but they express it in different ways. In most undertakings, there can be as much action in the preparation as in the execution. In finding your own place in the world, you should analyze yourself to find out whether you are a dynamo or a balance wheel, and then select a definite chief aim that harmonizes with your native ability. If you are in business with others, you should analyze them as well as yourself and endeavor to see that each person takes the part for which their temperament and native ability best fit. The dynamo or promoter type makes an able salesperson and organizer. The balance wheel or caretaker type makes an excellent conserver of assets after they have been accumulated. Place the caretaker type in charge of a set of books and they are happy, but place them on the outside selling and they are unhappy and will be a failure at their job. Place the promoter in charge of a set of books and they will be miserable. Their nature demands more intense action. Action of the passive type will not satisfy their ambitions, and if they are kept at work that does not give them the action their nature demands, they will be a failure. It very frequently turns out that people who embezzle funds in their charge are of the promoter type, and they would not have yielded to temptation had their efforts been confined to the work for which they are best suited. Give a person the sort of work that harmonizes with their nature, and the best there is in them will exert itself. One of the tragedies of the world is that most people never find the work for which they are best suited by nature. Too often the mistake is made, in the selection of a life work, of engaging only in the work that seems to be the most monetarily profitable. If money alone brought success, this procedure would be all right, but success in its highest and noblest form calls for peace of mind and enjoyment and happiness, which come only to the person who has found the work that they like best. An important purpose of this course is to help you analyze yourself to determine what your native ability best fits you to do. We come now to the discussion of the principle through which action may be developed. Understanding how to become active requires understanding how not to procrastinate. I offer these suggestions. Number 1. Form the habit of each day doing the most distasteful tasks first. This procedure will be difficult in the beginning, but after you have formed the habit, you will take pride in first dealing with the hardest and most undesirable part of your work. Number 2. Place this sign in front of you where you can see it in your daily work, and put a copy where you can see it before you go to sleep and when you arise. And the sign should say, "Do not tell them what you can do, show them." Number 3. Repeat the following words aloud 12 times each night just before you go to sleep. Tomorrow, I will do everything that should be done, when it should be done, and as it should be done. I will perform the most difficult tasks first, because this will destroy the habit of procrastination and develop the habit of action in its place. Number 4. Carry out these instructions with faith in their soundness, and with belief that they will develop action, in body and in mind, sufficient to enable you to realize your definite chief aim. I would like to refer back to what I said about the value of a hearty laugh as a healthful stimulant to action, and add that singing produces the same effect and in some instances is far preferable to laughing. Billy Sunday is one of the most dynamic and active preachers in the world. Yet, it has been said that his sermons would lose much of their effectiveness if it were not for the psychological effect of his song services. Editor's Comment. William Ashley Sunday, born in 1868 in Ames, Iowa, grew up in an orphanage, worked as a janitor while in high school, and in 1883 became a professional baseball player with the Chicago White Sox. In 1886, it was through the psychological effect of the song service at the Pacific Garden Mission in Chicago that Sunday became a born-again Christian. He later declined a $400 monthly baseball contract in favor of becoming a YMCA secretary, eventually accepted an assistant ministry position paying $84 a month, and in 1896 became an evangelical preacher himself. In his 20 years of preaching throughout America, Sunday's following was in the millions with hundreds of thousands of converts, and at his Detroit revival, there were 5,000 singers in the choir. Billy Sunday was not only active, but virtually acrobatic in his fire and brimstone preachings. His moralistic revival meetings condemned, among other sins, birth control and liquor, and Sunday campaigned passionately for the passage of prohibition laws. Henry Ford is said to have told him that if the law were enacted in Michigan, the breweries could be converted to produce denatured alcohol as fuel for his automobiles. By the time prohibition ended in 1934, his following had declined dramatically. Billy Sunday died in 1936. Returning to Napoleon Hill's original text. If church attendance had nothing else to recommend it, except the psychological effect of the song service, that would be sufficient, for no one can join in the singing of a beautiful hymn without feeling better for it. For many years, I have observed that I could write more effectively after having participated in a song service. Prove my statement to your own satisfaction by going to church and participating in the song service with all the enthusiasm at your command. During the war, I helped devise ways and means of speeding production in industrial plants that were engaged in manufacturing war supplies. By actual test, in a plant employing 3,000 men and women, the production was increased 45% in less than 30 days after we had organized the workers into singing groups and installed orchestras and bands that played at 10-minute intervals such stirring songs as Over There and Dixie and There'll Be a Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight. The workers caught the rhythm of the music and speeded up their work accordingly. Properly selected music would stimulate any group of workers to greater action, a fact which does not seem to be understood by all who direct the efforts of large numbers of people. In all my travels, I have found but one business firm whose managers made use of music as a stimulant for their workers. This was the Filene Department Store in Boston, Massachusetts. During the summer months, this store provides an orchestra that plays the latest dance music for half an hour in the morning before opening time. The salespeople use the aisles of the store for dancing, and by the time the doors are thrown open, they are in an active state of mind and body that carries them through the entire day. Incidentally, I have never seen more courteous or efficient salespeople than those employed by the Filene store. One of the department managers told me that every person in his department performed more service and with less real effort as a result of the morning music program. There is a book entitled Singing Through Life with God by George Wharton James, which I recommend to all who are interested in the psychology of song. Editor's Commentary. It's interesting that the majority of books Napoleon Hill recommended in 1928 are still available today, although this one is among the harder to come by. It is out of print, but available through used book dealers. The three copies listed in Barnes & Noble's out-of-print books ranged in price from $47 to $101. Needless to say, in the time since Hill reported that he could find only one business that used music to stimulate workers, it is now hard to find a retail store that doesn't have music playing from the time they open till they close at the end of the day. The major departure from Hill's theory is that today, music is used to influence customers as much as to stimulate employees. The companies that specialize in providing piped-in music conduct research into everything from musical theory to traffic flow patterns and changing blood sugar levels in order to program the right kind of music for the right customer demographics and the right time of day. Although the contemporary use of music in American retail stores became a modification of Napoleon Hill's idea, others took the suggestion literally. One of the most talked-about examples of the effectiveness of music to stimulate employees comes from modern industrial Japan. During the 1970s, as the large Japanese automobile and electronics manufacturers were rising to world prominence, much attention was focused on the way the Japanese managers motivated their workers. The stories and pictures that appeared in business magazines startled their American counterparts. What the picture showed was exactly what Napoleon Hill had in mind. Whole Japanese workforces gathering before the workday began to exercise together and sing what amounted to corporate team songs or cheers. Resuming Napoleon Hill's original text. Any form of group effort, where two or more people form a cooperative alliance for the purpose of accomplishing a definite purpose, becomes more powerful than mere individual effort. A football team may win consistently and continuously by well-coordinated teamwork, even though the members of the team may be unfriendly and out of harmony in many ways outside of their actual work on the field. A group composing a board of directors may disagree with one another, they may be unfriendly and in no way in sympathy with one another, and still carry on a business that appears to be very successful. A husband and wife may live together, raise a family, and accumulate a fair size or even a great fortune without the bond of harmony that is essential for the development of a mastermind. But all of these alliances might be made more powerful and effective if based upon a foundation of perfect harmony, thus permitting the development of the supplemental power of the mastermind. All cooperative effort produces power, there can be no doubt of this. But cooperative effort that is based upon complete harmony of purpose develops superpower. Let every member of any cooperative group set their hearts on the achievement of the same definite end, in a spirit of perfect harmony, and the way has been paved for the development of a mastermind, providing all members of the group willingly subordinate their own personal interests for the attainment of the objective for which the group is aiming. These United States were born as the result of one of the most powerful masterminds ever created. The members of this mastermind were the signers of the Declaration of Independence. The men who signed that document, either consciously or unconsciously, put into operation the power known as the mastermind, and that power was sufficient to enable them to defeat all the soldiers who were sent into the field against them. The men who fought to make the Declaration of Independence endure did not fight for money alone. They fought for a principle, the principle of freedom, which is the highest known motivating force. A great leader, whether in business, finance, industry, or statesmanship, is one who understands how to create a motivating objective that will be accepted with enthusiasm by every member of their group of followers. In politics, a live issue is everything. A live issue is some popular objective that the majority of the voters can be rallied toward the attainment of. These issues are generally broadcast in the form of snappy slogans such as "Keep Cool with Coolidge," which suggested to the minds of the voters that to keep Coolidge was the equivalent of keeping prosperity. And it worked. During Lincoln's election campaign, the cry was, "Stand back of Lincoln and preserve the Union." It worked. Woodrow Wilson's campaign managers, during his second campaign, coined the slogan, "He kept us out of war." It worked, too. The degree of power created by the cooperative effort of any group of people is measured, always, by the nature of the motive that the group is laboring to attain. This may be profitably kept in mind by all who organize group efforts for any purpose whatsoever. Find a motive around which people may be induced to rally in a highly emotionalized, enthusiastic spirit of perfect harmony, and you have found the starting point for the creation of a mastermind. Most people will work harder for the attainment of an ideal than they will for mere money. In searching for a motive as the basis for developing cooperative group effort, it will be profitable to bear this in mind. Give someone a sufficiently vitalized motive, and even the person of average ability under ordinary circumstances will suddenly develop superpower. What a man can and will accomplish to please the woman of his choice has ever been a source of wonderment to students of the human mind. There are three major motivating forces to which man responds in practically all of his efforts. Number one, the motive of self-preservation. Number two, the motive of sexual contact. Number three, the motive of financial and social power. Leaders who are seeking a motivating force out of which to secure action may find it under one or more of these three classifications. The three major motivating forces of mankind have been noted here for the guidance of the leader who wishes the cooperation of followers who will throw themselves into carrying out his or her plans in a spirit of unselfishness and perfect harmony. We do well that which we love to do. And fortunate is the leader who has the good judgment to assign all of his followers the roles that harmonize with this law. Regardless of who you are or what your definite chief aim may be, if you plan to attain the object of your chief aim through the cooperative efforts of others, you must set up in the minds of those whose cooperation you seek a motive strong enough to ensure their full, undivided, unselfish cooperation. When you do, you will be empowering your plans with the law of the mastermind. As you will have observed, this lesson is very closely related to Lesson 1 and Lesson 2, Volume 1, which cover the law of the mastermind. It is possible for groups to function cooperatively without creating a mastermind, such as when people cooperate merely out of necessity and without the spirit of harmony as the basis of their efforts. This sort of cooperation may produce considerable power, but it doesn't compare with what is possible when every person in an alliance subordinates their own individual interests. The extent to which people may be induced to cooperate in harmony depends on the motivating force that impels them to action. The perfect harmony that is essential for creating a mastermind develops only when the motivating force of a group is sufficient to cause each member of the group to completely forget his or her own personal interests and work for the good of the group, or for the sake of attaining some idealistic, charitable, or philanthropic objective. You are now ready for Lesson 14, which will teach you how to make working capital out of all mistakes, errors, and failures that you have experienced, and also how to profit by the mistakes and failures of others. The president of one of the great railway systems of the United States said, after reading the next lesson, that this lesson carries a suggestion which, if heeded and understood, will enable any person to become a master in his chosen life work. For reasons that will be clear after you have heard it, profiting by failure is my favorite lesson of this course. Indecision, an after-the-lesson visit with the author. Procrastination robs you of opportunity. It is a significant fact that no great leader was ever known to procrastinate. You are fortunate if ambition drives you into action, never permitting you to falter or turn back once you have rendered a decision to go forward. You may be shocked if you kept accurate account of the time you waste in a single day. Second by second, as the clock ticks off the distance, time is running a race with you. Delay means defeat, because no one may ever make up a second of lost time. Wasted time is one of the chief causes of failure. Time is also, however, a master worker that heals the wounds of failure and disappointment, and rights all wrongs, and turns all mistakes into capital. But it favors only those who kill off procrastination and remain in action when there are decisions to be made. Life is a great checkerboard. The player opposite you is time. If you hesitate, you will be wiped off the board. If you keep moving, you may win. The only real capital is time, but it is capital only when used. The other player is Mr. Average Man. Let us call him you. Move by move, time has wiped off Mr. Average Man's men until he is finally cornered where time will get him, no matter which way he moves. Indecision has driven him into that corner. Ask any well-informed salesperson, and they will tell you that indecision is the outstanding weakness of the majority of people. Every salesperson is familiar with that old excuse, "Let me think it over," which is the last line of defense of those who do not have the courage to say either yes or no. While they can't decide which way to move, time forces them into a corner where they can't move. The great leaders of the world were men and women of quick decision. General Grant had but little to commend him as an able general, except the quality of firm decision. But this was sufficient to offset all of his weaknesses. The whole story of his military success may be gathered from his reply to his critics when he said, "We will fight it out along these lines if it takes all summer." When Napoleon Bonaparte reached a decision to move his armies in a given direction, he permitted nothing to cause him to change that decision. If his line of march brought his soldiers to a ditch dug by his opponents to stop him, he would give the order to charge the ditch until it had been filled with dead men and horses sufficient to bridge it. The suspense of indecision drives millions of people to failure. A condemned man once said that the thought of his approaching execution was not so terrifying once he had reached the decision in his own mind to accept the inevitable. Lack of decision is the chief stumbling block of all revival meeting workers. Their entire work is to get men and women to reach a decision in their own minds to accept a given religious tenet. Billy Sunday once said, "Indecision is the devil's favorite tool." Andrew Carnegie visualized a great steel industry, but that industry would not be what it is today if he had not reached a decision in his own mind to transform his vision into reality. James J. Hill saw, in his mind's eye, a great transcontinental railway system. But that railroad never would have become a reality had he not reached a decision to start the project. Millions of people have imagination and build plans that would easily bring them both fame and fortune. But those plans never reach the decision stage. Demosthenes was a poor Greek lad who had a strong desire to be a great public speaker. Nothing unusual about that. Others have desired this and similar ability without living to see their desires realized. But Demosthenes added decision to desire, and despite the fact that he was a stammerer, he mastered this handicap and made himself one of the great orators of the world. Samuel Insull was an ordinary stenographer in the employ of Thomas A. Edison. Through the aid of his imagination, he saw the great commercial possibilities of electricity. But he did more than see the possibilities. He reached a decision to transform the mere possibilities into realities. And today, he is a multimillionaire electric light plant operator. Edwin C. Barnes reached a decision in his own mind to become the partner of Thomas A. Edison. Handicapped by lack of schooling, without money to pay his railroad fare, and with no influential friends to introduce him to Mr. Edison, young Barnes made his way to East Orange on a freight car, and so thoroughly sold himself to Mr. Edison that he got his opportunity, which led to a partnership. Today, just 20 years since that decision was reached, Mr. Barnes lives at Bradenton, Florida, retired with all the money he needs. William Wrigley Jr. reached a decision to devote his entire business career to the manufacture and sale of a 5-cent package of chewing gum. He has made that decision bring him financial returns running into the millions of dollars a year. Henry Ford reached a decision to manufacture and sell a popular priced automobile that would be within the means of all who wish to own it. That decision has brought enormous power to Ford and has brought travel opportunity to millions of people. All these men had two outstanding qualities: a definite purpose and a firm decision to transform that purpose into reality. The person of decision gets what he or she goes after, no matter how long it takes or how difficult the task. An able salesman wanted to meet a Cleveland banker. The banker would not see him. One morning, this salesman waited near the banker's house until he saw him get into his car and head downtown. Watching his opportunity, the salesman drove his own car into the banker's, causing slight damage to the car. The salesman got out of his car, handed the banker his card, expressed regret about the damage done, and promised the banker a new car, exactly like the one that had been damaged. That afternoon, a new car was delivered to the banker, and out of that transaction grew a friendship that developed into a business partnership that still exists. The person of decision cannot be stopped. The person of indecision cannot be started. Make your own choice. The following is from a poem by Joaquin Miller. Behind him lay the gray Azores, behind the gates of Hercules. Before him, not the ghosts of shores. Before him, only shoreless seas. The good mate said, "Now must we pray, for lo, the very stars are gone. Brave admiral, speak. What shall I say?" "Why, say, sail on and on." When Columbus began his famous voyage, he made one of the most far-reaching decisions in the history of mankind. Had he not remained firm on that decision, the freedom of America as we know it today would never have been known. Take notice of those about you and observe this significant fact. The successful men and women are those who reach decisions quickly and then stand firmly by those decisions after they are made. If you are one of those who make up their minds today and change them again tomorrow, you are doomed to failure. If you are not sure which way to move, it is better to shut your eyes and move in the dark than to remain still and make no move at all. The world will forgive you if you make mistakes, but it will never forgive you if you make no decisions, because it will never hear of you outside the community in which you live. No matter who you are or what may be your life work, you are playing checkers with time. It is always your next move. Move with quick decision and time will favor you. Stand still and time will wipe you off the board. You cannot always make the right move, but if you make enough moves, you may take advantage of the law of averages and pile up a creditable score before the great game of life is ended.